Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
5 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Glad you're with us for another edition of On DOD, one of our weekly programs focusing on defense and the Defense Department. Today we're going to do something a little bit different from the shows that we've done so far and take a look back at one of the key factors that made the military that we have today what it is. The year we just closed the books on, 2011, was the 25th anniversary of the Goldwater-Nichols Act. We mark the anniversary on Federal News Radio with a look back on how that big defense reorganization made its way through Congress and how lawmakers really dragged the Pentagon kicking and screaming into the culture of jointness that we know today. One of the key people behind Goldwater-Nichols was Jim Locker. At the time, in 1986, he was a professional staff member on the Senate Armed Services Committee, working for both the chairman, Barry Goldwater, and the ranking Democrat, Sam Nunn. A staff study that Locker led formed the basis for the legislation, and Locker literally wrote the book on Goldwater-Nichols. He wrote a comprehensive account of the Act's passage, a book called Victory on the Potomac. After working in Congress, he went on to serve as an Assistant Secretary of Defense and now the head of the Project on National Security Reform, which is pushing for tighter integration of the national security missions of the non-DOD federal agencies. Today we're going to hear an extended version of an interview I conducted with him for our series. We'll start with his account of the testimony of General David Jones in 1982. Jones was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time. He broke ranks with the rest of the Pentagon's leadership and told Congress the Joint Chiefs system didn't work. As Locker says, he knew at the time he was launching a holy war against the Pentagon bureaucracy.
General Jones's testimony to the Congress sparked some interest on Capitol Hill. Congress knew nothing about the organization of the Pentagon. It focused on the defense budget, the kinds of responsibilities the Congress had for defense authorization and appropriation. And so it had to become knowledgeable, something that took the Congress 4 years and 241 days to master.
So up until that point, really, the Pentagon had organized itself without much assistance, without much knowledge from Congress. Is that the right interpretation?
Well, the Congress was at fault in part. After World War II, President Truman wanted to create a unified military establishment. And the Army and the Army Air Corps supported that idea. They had actually wanted more unification during World War II. The Army was a huge institution at that time, 8 million people, and the Air Force was the new darling. It had the atomic weapon and had done strategic bombing. And the Navy and the Marine Corps were fearful that if they went into a single defense establishment, that they would be overshadowed by the Army and the Air Force. So they resisted Truman's ideas. Secretary of the Navy James Forrestal led the opposition. But the Congress, for its part, was fearful of allowing the executive branch to consolidate power too much in single officials, whether they were civilian or military. The Congress liked power to be diffused. It also enabled the Congress to play a more powerful role on things of local political interest, where ships were going to be built and battalions were going to be posted. So the majority of Congress did not favor Truman's approach and sided with the Navy and the Marine Corps. So when the National Security Act was passed in 1947 and created what eventually became the Department of Defense, the services retain considerable power. The Secretary of Defense was a rather weak official with limited support. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was not created until 2 years later. And then he was just an equal with the other service chiefs. So the Congress deserves some of the blame as well for creating a department where the components were way too powerful and the integrating elements were too weak.
I get the strong sense that a lot of the problems that Goldwater-Nichols attempted to address were long known, were identified long before, and folks had pointed out the need for reform. Am I right on that? And why did it not happen earlier?
Well, you're absolutely right. There were 40 years of studies done that examined problems in the military establishment. It was not possible, though, to overcome that alliance between the majority of Congress and powerful elements in the Defense Department, the Navy and the Marine Corps in the beginning, but eventually the Army and the Air Force saw the benefits of independence. Even President Eisenhower, a military hero of enormous stature, was not able to directly take on the major features. He did work to strengthen the Secretary of Defense through an internal executive actions, but he also had legislation passed in 1958 that strengthened the Secretary of Defense, but did not take on some of the fundamental challenges. And I think he understood that politically he could not make it happen. Now, interestingly, President Eisenhower had the service chiefs come to the White House where he would lecture them to say that their role was to be thinking of the nation's requirements, not the narrower needs of their services. But it was this alliance that had prevented any corrective actions. And that's why General Jones is such a hero, because he broke ranks with the military brotherhood and went to Capitol Hill and said the system was broken, and appeal to the Congress to fix it. When General Jones became chairman in 1978, he then believed that the joint system, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Joint Staff, and the Unified Commands, that system was broken. But he thought he could change it from the inside. He was frustrated by the service chiefs, who rejected all of his ideas for improving their collective performance. And then when Desert One happened, the failure in the Iranian desert, it convinced General Jones it was going to take outside pressure, either the president or the Congress. He did not believe that President Carter, who was politically weakened by the failure in Desert One, could take on this issue. So he waited to see the outcome of the election. And when President Reagan was elected, he approached Secretary of Defense Designate Caspar Weinberger with these ideas, indicating that he thought that this was an issue they needed to take on. Secretary Weinberger said that he was there to increase the defense budget to make up for the lapses that occurred during the Carter administration, and he did not favor the idea of exposing these deficiencies in defense organization. And so General Jones testified to the Congress with Secretary Weinberger sitting to his right. It was what we call the posture hearing, where the secretary and the chairman, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, present the defense budget to kick off the hearing cycle in the two Armed Services Committees. And they were in the House Armed Services Committee. And Secretary Weinberger gave his normal budget presentation. And when they turned to General Jones, General Jones said, "I look forward to talking to the committee one day about my views on the defense budget, but I have something much more important to talk to you about this morning." And then he gave a short statement about the deficiencies in the joint system and appealed for the Congress to take up this issue.
So he drops this bombshell unexpectedly in this hearing, says the Joint Chiefs of Staff system as it's constituted now doesn't work, and gets almost no follow-up questions from members, right?
That's right. You know, this was not a subject that the Congress was really familiar with. It did not examine defense organization. And so there was only one member that really picked up on it, Ike Skelton, who later became the chairman, a real military historian. And he began to ask questions. But there was a staffer there who had retired Air Force colonel by the name of Arch Barrett, who had been part of his study of defense organization during the Carter administration. And he understood exactly what General Jones was talking about and was able to get the investigation subcommittee to examine these issues. So General Jones did serve as an important catalyst for making this happen.
We'll take a quick break and come back with more of our interview with Jim Locker, the director of the Project on National Security Reform and a former Senate Armed Services staff member who helped get the Goldwater-Nichols Act passed and reform the organization of the military just over 25 years ago. You're listening to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serville. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thanks for joining us as we continue our conversation with Jim Locker, the former Senate Armed Services Committee staff member who helped push through the Goldwater-Nichols Act a little more than 25 years ago. He's also the author of Victory on the Potomac, a book about the experience. In this segment, Locker talked with me about how Barry Goldwater, coming on as chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, changed the dynamic of defense reorganization efforts after previous reform bills after the earlier 3 years had passed the House but been quickly killed off in the Senate.
Senator Goldwater became chairman in January of 1985. It was his last 2 years in the Senate. He'd already announced that he was not going to run for reelection. We had been working on the committee staff for several years on a study on the issues that General Jones had raised, plus broader issues about defense organization. And before Senator Goldwater took over as chairman, I had the chance to brief him on this study. And Senator Goldwater had been involved with the military for 40 or 50 years. The problems that I was describing to him resonated with him. He had seen them. He didn't have a context for understanding their connections, but he thought that we really had some powerful ideas on what the problems were in the military establishment. And so he decided this was going to be his number one priority for his last 2 years in the Senate. And he knew if something this big had to be done on a bipartisan basis. And so he reached out to the ranking Democrat, Senator Sam Nunn, and they formed a genuine partnership to take this issue on. And when they started, they could only count on three or four other senators supporting them. So Senator Goldwater and Senator Nunn put together a 13-month program of study and persuading members of the committee as to this need. They created a task force on defense organization, which the two of them co-chaired, and they added seven other senators, and they met every Wednesday morning to study these particular issues. And after that 13-month period, they finally had 10 votes out of 19, but there was still unbelievable opposition from the uniformed services. And from the services' perspective, they were looking to retain the power and independence and prerogatives that they had had since the National Security Act of 47 was passed. It did not meet the nation's needs. Besides General Jones, that partnership between Senator Goldwater and Senator Nunn was the second most important factor in the passage of Goldwater-Nichols. At the time, we had a Republican in the White House, Ronald Reagan, and we had a Democratic House, but we had a Republican Senate. So those in the administration who were opposed to these legislative changes focused their attention on the Senate Armed Services Committee. That became the real battleground. When you put that whole military-industrial complex together and its lobbying 19 members of the committee and their staff, it can be a tremendous amount of pressure and opposition.
Yeah, that's an important point, I think. It's not as though the chiefs are off grumbling in a corner somewhere. They're actively trying to subvert this process while Senator Goldwater and Senator Nunn are trying to coalesce support around it, right?
The chiefs themselves didn't have to, it was not like they had to mobilize an effort because there were lots of people in the services over that 40-year period who had shared these perspectives that the services were different and they needed to remain independent. So it was not necessarily orchestrated, but it was a pretty formidable opposition.
So Senator Goldwater, Senator Nunn have their first, I guess, face-to-face meeting with the chiefs in the tank one day. And to say there was resistance there, I think, would be an understatement based on the account that you tell in your book. You want to tell us that story?
It was quite stormy session in which the chiefs were strongly stating their views that the two senators and those that supported them were getting ready to make a big mistake, that empowering the combatant commanders and by making the chairman the principal military advisor, we would be undermining the system that had been put in place and placing the nation at risk. And this was quite an unusual session, because normally the chairman would be, or the Joint Chiefs of Staff would be quite deferential to the chairman and the ranking Democrat on the Armed Services Committee. But this was a no-holds-bar kind of discussion between them, where they were quite critical of what was being done and showed some of their anger and frustration over it during the session.
So what happens after that meeting? Are Goldwater and Nunn emboldened? Are they deterred? What's their attitude after this tense meeting?
When the meeting ended, I was wondering where the two senators were going to be. They were on shaky ground in their committee. There was a one-vote margin. We knew that there would be major efforts made to reverse that favorable position. And I thought that they may want to delay and strengthen their position. But in fact, it just increased their determination that this was something that was going to have to be enacted by Congress to make these fundamental changes in the Pentagon. And so they decided to press ahead with the planned markup of the bill.
Yeah, and, you know, I get the sense that the Hill is really the only, not even the Hill as a whole, the Senate, the Armed Services Committee is the only institution that really thought there was a need for change. Was there important support from anyone at the Pentagon that mattered, the White House, anywhere besides the Armed Services Committee?
Well, there was. Bud McFarlane was the National Security Advisor during this part of the Reagan administration. He'd been in the Marine Corps, served on the Senate Armed Services Committee staff before the beginning of the Reagan administration. And he thought the ideas that the two Armed Services Committees were developing were right on target. President Reagan and Secretary Caspar Weinberger were very close friends. And so in the beginning, the Reagan administration was quite negative. And so Bud McFarlane had to decide how he could bring President Reagan around on these issues. At the same time, there were lots of procurement scandals, the coffee pots that cost $6,000 and $500 toilet seats. And
that was all going on the same year, right?
It was.
1986?
It was unrelated to what we were doing, but it was of great concern to President Reagan. And so Bud McFarlane, over a series of months, convinced President Reagan to create the Packard Commission, headed by David Packard of Hewlett-Packard and a former Deputy Secretary of Defense. And the Packard Commission was given the responsibility for looking at acquisition, but they were also given responsibility for looking at all of the things that the Armed Services Committees were examining. And a very close relationship was established between Senator Goldwater and Senator Nunn and other leading members of the Senate Armed Services Committee and the Packard Commission. Great dialogue going back and forth and a sharing of ideas. And the Packard Commission came out and endorsed the ideas that were being developed on Capitol Hill. And the timing of their endorsement was just before we took the bill into the committee to be marked up. So there was that important reinforcement. And then there were think tanks. The Center for Strategic and International Studies did a report that was quite favorable early on. The Heritage Foundation had another report. Harvard University and the University of Kentucky issued a report. And these efforts had lots of people from the military establishment that were engaged.
Another break, and we'll come back with more of our interview with Jim Locker, the director of the Project on National Security Reform and a former Senate Armed Services staff member who helped get the Goldwater-Nichols Act passed and reform the organization of the military just over 25 years ago. When we come back, we'll talk about how the Pentagon went about implementing Goldwater-Nichols after it fought so bitterly to stop it from being passed. You're listening to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servio. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Glad you're with us for more of our conversation with Jim Locker. He's the director of the Project on National Security Reform and an expert on the Goldwater-Nichols Act, which marked its 25th anniversary in 2011. His book, Victory on the Potomac, chronicles his experience as a Senate staff member who helped shepherd the bill through Congress in the mid-1980s. Locker and others say even though the Pentagon brass fought bitterly to stop Goldwater-Nichols, that opposition seemed to melt away once the bill became law.
So the bill is passed. It's signed by the president. And tell me if I'm skipping over too many important details here. I hope you will. What happens next? How does implementation go? Is it fought by the Pentagon? Is it embraced reluctantly? What happens next?
Well, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time was Admiral Bill Crow, and he was a believer in these ideas. He had that awkwardness of trying to implement a new set of ideas after he had been practicing under the old system for a while. And so he had decided that he would move forward with these ideas, but he would do it at a gradual pace. The next chairman that came in was Colin Powell, and he had come to understand the importance of these particular changes. And for the nation, we were quite fortunate that such a skillful chairman came in at a pivotal moment in which implementation was going to be tremendously important. And General Powell implemented the ideas fully, and we started seeing the benefits. And so momentum began to pick up. Military officers, more than a fair share of the best and brightest, wanted to serve in joint assignments, and they began to build a joint culture. So the implementation was smoother than you might have anticipated, in part because of key leaders on the military side of the Pentagon.
Yeah, that's one of the changes that you highlight. The joint officer billets went from a place that was kind of seen as a, I don't know, career graveyard to something that was prestigious all of a sudden. Or was it all of a sudden?
It was viewed by military officers as something they wanted to do. And it's where the most important work was going to be done, in the joint staff and in the headquarters of the unified commands. So military officers wanted to serve in those assignments, and the joint staff became an incredibly capable organization. A few years later, from 1989 to 1993, I served as an assistant secretary of defense, and I know how extremely capable the joint staff was. It was exactly what the nation needed in terms of military advice and military thinking.
And then in terms of the way the military operated, the first, I guess, post-Goldwater-Nichols tests of effectiveness are what? Panama and Gulf War I, right?
Yes.
What did that show us about how well this was working?
Well, it revealed exactly the benefits that the Congress had foreseen in having a combatant commander in the field, Maxwell Thurman, General Maxwell Thurman, down in Panama, have the ability to put together exactly the war fighting team that was required, to have complete unity of command and unity of effort. Panama, some people thought, was the most brilliant military operation since World War II. And then in Desert Shield, Desert Storm, you had General Schwarzkopf, who greatly benefited from the ability to put together all of the capabilities of his command, regardless of service, and was quite successful there. And both of those operations were a major shot in the arm for the Goldwater-Nichols Act, and demonstrated to lots of people in the military establishment that this was an important direction to go.
Now, we're talking only 5 years after enactment, which it seems like this happened relatively quickly, that we started seeing pretty immediate benefits.
We did. There were other areas that took longer. The joint officer provisions took longer to get the benefits of that in the creation of a true joint culture. But there were very tangible results. Matter of fact, the first occasion in which the new powers of the combatant commanders were used were in the Kuwaiti reflagging effort in the Persian Gulf. And I remember, you know, Admiral Crow describing how having the combatant commander have the authority to direct the service forces was incredibly important. But right away in Operation Just Cause in Panama and in Desert Shield and Desert Storm, we got to see the act in operation in a very beneficial way.
So you were an OSD for part of this and an observer for other parts of it. How long do you think it took before this was seen throughout the building retrospectively as a good idea? Or are we there yet?
Today people wonder how in the world we didn't do this earlier than 1986. That just seems so natural to them. And if you go out into the field, if you go to the combatant commands, they are thinking joint at every moment. that service parochialism has completely disappeared, and people are just amazed at how those organizations are unified. How long it took? One thing that began to happen as junior officers came into the service, this seemed so natural to them. And so maybe someplace in the mid-1990s, it became completely accepted, second nature in lots of places. I was beginning then to do lots of lecturing at the war colleges where the junior officers were tremendously receptive to these ideas and didn't see any reason why they shouldn't be pushed further. And in that regard, there's an important point to mention. Goldwater Nichols did the broad strokes on moving to jointness. But there was lots of innovation inside the Department of Defense. When people kind of understood what was possible, they've developed ideas, joint task forces. You know, jointness has gone down to a much lower level than anybody could have anticipated in 1986. And so there are lots of bright minds in the Pentagon have worked hard to take full advantage of the legislation.
Yeah, you said that the junior officers came in sort of accepting this as a native concept. That tells me that training and doctrine transformed pretty quickly once DOD understood this was happening.
Well, the chairman was given responsibility in Goldwater Nichols to do joint doctrine and to specify joint training and to oversee the joint officer personnel policies. And, you know, as they began to pump out joint doctrine, and we finally had that context for putting all of the capabilities together, all of that became quite important.
Secretary Gates, when he announced the disestablishment of Joint Forces Command, said a lot of the things that you're saying. You know, jointness is just baked in now. We don't need a four-star command to do this anymore. Is he right on that, do you think? Is there, with GFCOM gone now, is there a danger of backsliding, especially in a time like this where there's some incentive for the services to squabble for dollars?
Well, I think a lot of what Secretary Gates said was true, that it is accepted. But there is kind of the question of who's going to be thinking about the next set of joint innovations. Where do we go next? And where is the home for that? Where are we going to be doing those joint experimentations that GFCOM had done? And that's sort of an unanswered question. Where will that occur? And how do we make certain that we're continuing to benefit from a new set of ideas that improve our ability to be a joint warfighting force?
We'll take one final break and wrap up our conversation with Jim Locker, director of the Project on National Security Reform. When we come back, we'll talk about the effort his group is working on a quarter century after Goldwater Nichols, bringing the same kind of jointness the military now benefits from to the non-DOD federal agencies. This is On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thanks for joining us for one final segment with Jim Locker, the former Senate Armed Services Committee staff member who helped push through the Goldwater-Nichols Act a little more than 25 years ago. Today, he leads the Project on National Security Reform. He tells me one of his group's key agenda items is bringing a whole-of-government approach to the civilian federal agencies, at least with regard to their national security missions.
The issues of today are so complex. None of the national security missions can be taken on by a single department. Our government is not organized for that. You know, our government is organized in the stovepipes. They can't work across the stovepipes in the ways that are required. Lots of people refer to this as a Goldwater-Nichols Act for the interagency system. And it's very similar. At the time of Goldwater-Nichols, we had great capability in the four services, but they were not able to work jointly. In today's world, we have lots of capability in the Defense Department, less in the civilian departments and agencies, which are scrapped for resources and have not prepared themselves well for the challenges of the 21st century. But they do need to be able to work together. They're not able to do that today. And that's going to require some major changes in our national security organization. It's going to require a transformation. And some of these kinds of changes have already occurred in business. There are two things that are plaguing the national security system. One is complexity, and the other is speed of change. The business world had to address those same challenges, and they went to creating horizontal teams, teams that were able to work all the way across the corporation to bring all of the corporation's expertise readily available to solve an issue that was confronting the corporation. We are still very vertical down through the departments and agencies. We're beginning to see some horizontal teams. They've ended up being temporary in nature, taken way too long to form, ineffective because of resistance by the departments and agencies. But our government will need to move in that direction. We have been dominated by the departments since 1947. And the integrating mechanisms, the National Security Council and its subgroups, are institutionally weak by comparison. And just like in the Defense Department, we have the Joint Staff, we have the Combatant Commands, we have Joint Task Forces, and we have even more subordinate organizations that can work jointly. In our government, we'll need the same kinds of changes. We also need to recognize that national security has changed. After World War II, it was diplomacy, military, and intelligence. And in many people's minds, it's still that. If you look at the National Security Council, that's the membership. The Secretary of Energy was added a few years ago by the Congress. But in today's world, national security is the economy. So there are all of those issues. It's energy. There are health dimensions. It's trade. And those need to be integrated into the national security system. So there are big changes ahead for our government.
Of the problems that you're describing, how much of it is really structural? In other words, things that you just need to change statutorily, and how much of it is cultural barriers to whole of government approaches, to information sharing, to collaboration? Is there an analog to the stovepipes that were there in the services before Goldwater Nichols on DOD?
Lots of it is cultural, the separateness between the various departments and agencies. When we were doing Goldwater Nichols, everybody was wearing a uniform. And so while there were cultural differences, they weren't as different as if you think about going from the FBI to the intelligence community or the Department of Health and Human Services. There we can talk about some real cultural gaps. So there is that big cultural challenge and preparing people for serving in interagency assignments. I always say we allow people to fly the interagency airplane without ever having gone to flight school. We don't prepare them at all. We don't reward them. The incentives are very much reinforcing the departmentalism. People are not incentivized for looking out for the broader national outcome or mission. But when you say structural changes, the departments themselves can remain as they are. What's missing is that integrating across it. And it's more of a process kinds of team, kinds of effort, creating interagency teams to be able to pull together the capability that's in the departments and agencies. And so there'll be lots of changes required to make that happen, just as we did in the Defense Department when we went from the War Department and the Navy Department into combatant commands, into joint task forces, into a joint staff.
This process of creating horizontal integration teams, in your mind, is that led by a sort of strengthened and revitalized National Security Council or some other structure?
Well, it will have to start with the National Security Staff, as it's called today. The National Security Staff does not have it has very limited power. It's an advisory group. The National Security Advisor doesn't even exist in the law. When General Jim Jones took over as the National Security Advisor, he had a budget of $8.6 million. He's sitting at the top of this huge national security system with a budget of $8.6 million. But the real trick will be creating interagency teams that are subordinate to the National Security Staff that can do much of this work. teams that are made up of people from the different departments and agencies. So they bring that department and agency expertise, and they're linked back to those departments and agencies, but they're not there to defend departmental ideology. They're there to think about what is the national mission, what is the national outcome that's desired, and how do we put together policy strategies, plans, budgets to achieve those. And that's what's missing in our system today.
I want to go back to something you said a minute ago, that the current incentive structure rewards departmentalism instead of collaboration, instead of a whole of government approach. Can you think of examples of those badly aligned incentives right now, and what a good incentive structure would look like?
Well, the majority of people who serve on the national security staff are seconded there by the departments and agencies. They're there for a temporary assignment, 2 years normally, because the burnout rate is quite high given the pace of activity there. And then they go back to their department and agency. So while they're there, they're being monitored for loyalty by their department and agency. They belong to the national security staff, and they're trying to do the will of the president. But there are limits to how far they are going to push their department or agency on an issue of major concern. And so we, just as we did in Goldwater Nichols, we made joint assignments important for the promotion process, but we also protected joint officers. You know, their promotions and their assignments were monitored by the chairman and the joint staff for the rest of their careers to make certain that they were not punished for the service that they performed when they were in the joint organization. And somehow we have to create those same incentives in the interagency space, because the people, just like joint officers, have become hugely important in the Department of Defense, people who can put together all of that capability of the services and think the whole of the Department of Defense. People who will have the ability to think whole of government in the national security system will become tremendously important. So developing them, incentivizing them, rewarding them will become a major challenge.
As far as creating a 21st century Goldwater Nichols, you said before that it was the bipartisan partnership between Senator Goldwater and Senator Nunn was instrumental to getting that done. Do you despair when you look at our current Congress that can't even get a budget passed?
Well, I left Congress in 1989 to go to the Pentagon, and then there was a period after I left government in 93 until I started the project on national security reform in early 2006, where I didn't have much interaction with the Congress. And when I began to work the Congress on national security reform, I found a very different Congress than the one that I'd known for 11 years from 1978 to 1989. When I was there, it was possible to take big challenges to members. And even if the political odds were not favorable, people would be prepared to build those coalitions, those bipartisan coalitions, to make things happen. Right now, what we're finding on Capitol Hill is that the political environment is so poisonous that people aren't prepared to take on these kinds of major challenges. They, in part, they know it's impossible, that they cannot find allies, and they will immediately be attacked. And so agendas are quite limited. So it's this kind of a big change to modernize the national security system will require the efforts by both the president and the Congress, and the environment is not right at the moment for making those changes.
I don't want to start to close out on an unhappy note. Do you see any prospect of that changing? Do you see any prospect of ways that this can get done?
This will happen. This has to happen. You know, the nation, not only is the national security system broken, but the nation is broke. We are going to have to think about new ways of doing business. We've always been ingenious in the past, and I'm certain that the time will come for these ideas. Just as Goldwater Nichols came to the Pentagon and transformed the military establishment, I'm certain that we will come to a point where we will put together that political coalition that's necessary to overcome the entrenched interest and produce a modern national security system.
That's Jim Locker, the director of the Project on National Security Reform. A little over 25 years ago, he was a professional Senate staff member who helped draft the Goldwater-Nichols Act. The interview you heard today was part of what made up our special series on the anniversary of Goldwater-Nichols in late 2011. You can hear that series online at federalnewsradio.com, where you can also listen to this one-hour conversation again, as well as any of our past shows. Thanks for joining us for On DoD, and we'll hope you tune in next week on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servia.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.